Thanks for joining us, Madam Chair and Mr Hutton. I've just got to read an opening statement before we get into it. So on behalf of the committee, I'd like to welcome you to the hearing. These proceedings are being recorded by Hansard, and a copy of the audio will be placed on the committee's website. Today, in the committee room, we have myself. I'm the Deputy Chair of the committee. My name is Colin Holt. We've got the Honourable Sam Rowe, who's a committee member, and the Honourable Tim Clifford as a committee member. We've had apologies from our Chair, Matthew Swinburne, today, and also another member in the Honourable Steve Thomas. We've got a clerk assisting the committee in Alex, sitting closest to the camera. And we've also got Hansard staff here who are recording the hearing. Before we begin, can you please state your full name and the capacity in which you appear before the committee?
Hi, good morning. I'm Catherine McKinnell, and as well as being MP for Newcastle North, I'm Chair of the Petitions Committee in the UK Parliament.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mark Hutton. I'm the Clerk of the Journals in the House of Commons, and have overall responsibility for the paper petition system and a degree of supervisory responsibility for the Petitions Committee from the organisational point of view.
Okay, excellent, thank you. You will have signed a document entitled Information for Witnesses. Have you read and understood that document?
Yes.
Thank you. If there is, for some reason, you want to make a confidential statement or give evidence in private, please let us know. And we might have to arrange some other way of taking the private evidence. I don't think this committee inquiry is that controversial or confidential, but in case you've got something you'd like to add in private, please let us know and we'll arrange something to happen. A transcript of your evidence will be provided to you. If you want to quote any documents, can you please quote the full title of the document so we might be able to access it later? And obviously with Zoom and Skype, we might have some connection issues, hopefully not. But if we have to ask or repeat the question, we may do that. And I remind you that the transcript of today's discussions will be made public. Until the transcript for your public evidence is finalised, it should not be made public by you. So that's the official bit out of the road. Welcome and thank you for your time this morning. Would you like to make any opening statements to the committee?
No, I mean, I'm delighted to be here to give evidence this morning, so thank you very much for the invitation, and it's always very helpful to be able to work together with other petitions committees so that we can all improve the way we engage with the public and provide a platform through petition. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, I have no statement I'd like to make. Thank you. As you know, we submitted some written evidence to you earlier in the year.
Yes, yeah, no, we appreciate that. And I think from our perspective, we've been going as a committee for 20 years and probably really the first real go at trying to review how we've been going and some of our systems, and obviously looking at how other jurisdictions do it differently to us or some that do it the same and take up same processes and see how effective it is. So that's really the basis of our inquiry. And it is about continual improvement. We think we do a pretty good job, but we'd like to learn from others, so we really appreciate your time. And I'll probably just attempt to go through some of the questions that we've provided you in advance. I often jump around a little bit depending on where your answers lead me, so forgive me if we kind of go back over some old ground as we go along. I keep getting reminded by the staff here I shouldn't be doing it, but that's how I operate, so that's all fine. In the submission from you, you talked about new and innovative ways of gathering evidence, such as roundtable discussions and consultation events. I guess we're interested in how that evolved and how valuable you see it as a role or a process for the committee.
So are you happy for me to start there?
Up to you.
Okay, fine. Yep. So, a traditional Westminster Select Committee obviously will take a decision on the sort of remit that it is looking into. It will take written evidence, it will then take oral evidence, and then it will produce a report. That's the traditional way that they operate. And I think it, because petitions are so topical and very close to the petitioners who have tabled that petition, and usually where there may be an inquiry following from that, it's because a large number of members of the public have signed and showed an interest in the issue, that as a committee we've looked at different ways of trying to include the petitioners within our evidence taking or our inquiries, and that's been on a in the way we take evidence, because obviously formal committees where you get experts in to give evidence, it can be pretty daunting. It can be quite logistically challenging for people to come into Parliament. Sometimes where you're trying to open it up to groups that don't normally have access to Parliament or wouldn't normally be engaged, finding a way that reaches those people has been a priority. So not only have we looked for different ways to engage, so online, for example, with web chats, with online forums, and we've also looked for geographically different ways of engaging, so taking the committee up to other parts of the country to meet with interested parties, stakeholders, and petitioners where they may be geographically as well. So all of that evidence, in the same way though, will be fed into an inquiry. It will be written up, it will result in a written report, but generally, rather than expecting everyone to come to Parliament, we will go out to the public to engage with them in that way.
Hmm. Anything to add, Mr. Hutton?
I think the only thing I'd add at the start, which I'm sure that Cathy would agree with, is that we should always bear in mind that a petitions committee in the UK Parliament was constituted on the back of the introduction of the e-petition system. I know you're not looking at introducing an e-petition system, but quite a lot of the engagement activity that they therefore pursue derives from the fact that they're working in an online platform with petitions and with the information that they gain through an e-petition system. We have a traditional paper petition system, and the petitions committee has a responsibility to look at it from time to time, but most of its innovative activity has been around the e-petitions that we've received. I think that's a fair comment.
Yeah, when I read that, I thought that was quite interesting, the fact that it instigated because of e-petitions and how to deal with them. And it seems from the opening comments from you, Madam Chair, that the philosophy of the committee is a people-first approach or a petitioners-first approach. Would that be right?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that the petition system, particularly the online petition system, has managed to open up Parliament to people that wouldn't normally necessarily engage or necessarily know how to engage. And I think because the public are familiar with petitioning as a concept, it goes back hundreds of years, that they can put that sort of concept of petitioning together with that direct engagement with Parliament. And so it's a way of reaching an audience that I think Parliament wouldn't normally. I think that obviously carries with it a huge responsibility as well, to ensure that that engagement with Parliament is a positive one. And that doesn't necessarily always mean that you can always do what the petitioners want, but we do work very hard to make sure that the petitioners always feel listened to and considered, and that their issues have been given a hearing. I mean, obviously that's all subject to limitations and the criteria, and where it's not possible to even provide that, to make sure that we have very clear outline of what can and can't be done, what will be considered and what won't be considered. But where there is a petition that does meet the criteria, it reaches the threshold. I think the ability to then communicate with those petitioners is quite very powerful, and the ability to keep them updated on how a petition might be progressing, what the response from the government might be, and indeed then move on to have a debate or to have an inquiry, and to keep them informed and, where possible, engaged in that process. So it can be a very powerful forum for bringing members of the public more aware of the workings of Parliament, and then, but also the responsibility of ensuring that that's a positive engagement rather than leaving them feeling dissatisfied with their experience.
Yeah, and it would seem to me that one of the major challenges of any petitions committee, and I would assume it's for you guys too, is how you decide which issues have the merit of full inquiries or taking oral evidence or travelling to a geographical region to take evidence. And have you got any decision-making tools that help you decide what you're going to do with a particular petition, or is it purely relying on the criteria and then the decisions of the committee, inbuilt decisions of the committee, if you like?
So there's two levels to this process, and as the chair, I tend to deal with petitions once they've been through that process. So maybe the initial process might be something that Mark is better placed to talk about, because that's something that the clerks and the team, the petitions team, they undertake significant amount of work to make sure that all the petitions that come through the system do come through in the right way. Obviously, as a committee, we formally consider every petition that's been open on the site up to after, but in terms of those that receive more than 10,000 signatures, we will then look to get a response from the government. We won't just accept any response from the government. It has to meet our criteria, and we have a whole list of criteria. It must be, it must respond to the petitioner's concern. It must be understandable. It can't use jargon. It has to be clear. And if we're not satisfied with the government's response, we will send it back for it to be improved until we feel it meets what the petitioners need. And then if it gets over 100,000 signatures, we will then consider what further action to take. And generally speaking, that would mean holding a debate in Parliament in Westminster Hall, and we would decide as a committee who is best placed to lead on that debate. Obviously, in the current situation, we aren't able to hold those debates in Parliament, and so that really has opened up a whole new set of challenges, but also opportunities to find different ways to make sure that petitioners' voices are heard. And so we are now undertaking, we're looking more at inquiries and undertaking inquiries into the issues that are being raised, rather than just relying on having a debate in Parliament and a government response. And I mean, clearly at the moment, many of the petitions that are being submitted are relating to coronavirus and the government's response and many of the public's concerns around those. So we're currently undertaking an inquiry into coronavirus and many of the different aspects, one of which is maternity leave and the impact of lockdown and COVID-19 on new parents and also on students who obviously are not able to complete their degrees in the normal way. So we're undertaking an inquiry. I think in normal circumstances, we would have a debate in Parliament on those issues.
Yeah.
And obviously members of Parliament would be able to contribute from their perspective according to petitioners that may have contacted them to let them know that they are concerned about this issue and would like them to speak on their behalf in the debate. So we do discourage members of Parliament from submitting petitions. There's no actual rule saying that they can't, but we would always prioritise petitions from members of the public on the basis that members of Parliament have other ways of raising issues with the government, and so the system really is prioritised for members of the public to be able to get their issues heard in Parliament. But obviously we do also have a paper petition system still, and those are submitted by members of Parliament. So that's another way for members of Parliament to submit petitions. And we do have to formally consider those as part of our work as well, but it's generally a formality because they wouldn't generally pass the threshold for us considering them as a committee, because generally they relate to a localised constituency issue, which we're very clear. We look at things on a more national scale rather than local constituency issues.
Yeah.
And I think Mark possibly has some comments on the the process that the committee go through before they come to our committee.
Yeah.
If that would be helpful, yes. The site, of course, receives petitions directly from the public, so there need to be six signatories before a petition is capable of being valid. The committee team look at all the submitted petitions that reach that level, which is quite a low level, frankly, and they do their best to help bring them within the rules. The rules are fairly broad. There's some questions you suggested you might have on things like therapeuticity coming later on, so there's rules like that. There's rules like comprehensibility and understanding that there is a responsibility for government or parliament being engaged by the petition, and rules against things that are jokes or are trivial. But by and large, the team work hard to get the petition into order, and will often go back to a petitioner and say, I'm not quite clear what you're trying to get at here. It could be this, it could be that. What would you prefer? There are some things that petitions, for example, can't do, like they can't go directly to the honours system, which is theoretically, on advice, something that is the responsibility of the Queen. So if they don't like, if a petitioner doesn't like someone having an honour or thinks someone with an honour should lose it, they can't petition on that point directly. They need to find a way of bringing in a generality, a policy issue. And that applies in some other areas too. Occasionally, but only very occasionally, a petition poses such difficulties as to which side of the line falls that the team will take it to the committee itself and ask the chair and members to rule on which way they think it should go. But actually, that's very rare. So most petitions get over that hurdle. The big reason for refusal, the main reason why a petition doesn't go live, is actually because it's a duplicate. So we only allow one petition on a specific issue at a time. And sometimes members of the public can get a little concerned about this, because where you say something is a duplicate, a member of the public may think, no, it's not exactly the same as the ones up there already, I've got a slightly different tilt on it. But the team has to manage the website. So there's a big rule against duplicates, which they do impose, and much the largest number of petitions that are not opened on the site for further signature are those which are deemed to be duplicates.
Right. Yep, so it's a two-stage process, really. But it sounds like, though, with the outcome is that to respect the petitioner's wishes of getting it at least looked at and potentially debated. If a petition of 100,000 signatures or over has a parliamentary debate, is it a binding vote on that debate, or what is it? What does it become?
So it becomes a motion within the debate that is unamendable. So you can't actually change the motion that's being debated, and it will generally, Ben, Mark might correct me, but I think the wording is generally that this House has considered petition number, and you name the number of the petition, and the title of the petition.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've led on a number of these, and sometimes also where you've combined a number of petitions on the same issue, but that are asking opposing things. So, I mean, one, I'm sure you haven't failed to notice the Brexit debate that has been going on for some time in the UK, and the debate, it was the largest signed numbers of signatories on a petition that I led the debate on, and it was putting both arguments at the same time. So, you know, we want to leave the European Union. I can't remember the wording of the exact debate, but revoke Article 50, we want to leave now, and the alternative, which is, implement Brexit without further delay. And so that allowed for a genuine debate on from both aspects, and to deal with both petitions at the same time, because clearly, in order to separate the two, you would be having the same debate twice in any case. And so at the end of it, there isn't necessarily a vote on the issue, it's that the issue has been considered.
Yep.
And if you've had a three-hour debate on the subject, generally speaking, members will be satisfied, even though they might not agree with everything that's been said, that there has been a debate on the issue. I've only seen one division that was brought, and I think that was sort of an unusual thing on a very controversial subject that we've had many petitions on and continue to have. I think that's one of the features as well of this system, is that once you've debated an issue, you've had a petition open for 6 months, it has received, you know, a significant number of signatures, it's been debated, or it may even have had an inquiry into it, and at the end of that process, there is still not necessarily a result that is satisfactory to the petitioners, then as soon as that six-month period is over, they can then straight away schedule another debate on the same issue to keep that debate going into the 6 months on from there. So there are some issues where, you know, every 6 months, pretty much the same subject is tabled for petition because they are not satisfied that the issue has been dealt with. And there's a whole range of examples of issues that petitioners remain unhappy that the government has still not responded in a way that they are satisfied.
Mm. I'm sure that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, use of fireworks is one example.
Yeah.
And I think it's inspired usually every November.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
You might be worth mentioning also that one of the things that the committee's communication specialists, media specialists, spend a lot of time doing is explaining to the public what they can expect from the process. So obviously a petitioner will bring in a petition hoping to change the law, to change the way the world is in some way, but a lot of work goes into communicating with petitioners about what they can actually expect. If they get enough signatures or get a government reply, if they get some more, they may get the debate. If they're lucky, they may get it picked up in some sort of inquiry with evidence taking. This is one part of a much broader campaign they may be launching on the issue that they're concerned with. Mm-hmm. So we try to manage the expectations and the understanding of the public who are involved in the process, so they don't simply think that because they don't get everything they want, they've got nothing. There's a lot of progress to be made in the areas they're interested in without necessarily getting exactly what they want.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because obviously there's a bit of a scale difference in our jurisdictions. You know, we're a state parliament rather than the national parliament. We deal with a wide range of petitions, from frivolous in nature, you would probably suggest, to major policy shifts. And you deal with them as you deal with them on their merits. Some don't go very far at all. Some go a long way and quite often do not meet the petitioner's expectations. They expect you to be a decision-making body when you aren't. But they're just all the challenges that each petition committee, I think, faces in terms of meeting expectations of a petition outcome. But I guess that's why we're looking at it, really. We want to ensure that our petitions process keeps up with the times and does its best it can to serve the people of Western Australia, I suppose.
Mm. If you don't mind, Chair, sorry.
Go for it.
I think having the criteria does make it easier to be able to manage the process in terms of the numbers that we receive, and being able to be clear with the petitioners about what can and cannot be debated, what can and cannot be achieved. But I think the other thing that we try to do as a committee is where we can't take their interests forward, to signpost them in the direction of where else in Parliament or indeed in public authorities, where else they may be able to take their concerns forward. I guess in the hope that rather than coming away dissatisfied that they haven't been listened to, that actually, even though it's not appropriate for us to take forward that issue, it doesn't mean it's necessarily the end of the road and there may be other options for them and to pursue it in other directions. And obviously we're always keen to ensure that people understand the difference between government and Parliament.
Uh-huh.
And the role of the Petitions Committee and the role of their constituency member of Parliament, all of whom have different functions, but that the public aren't always clear on what those are, which I'm sure you encounter as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And does the committee point that out to the petitioners? Like, you'd be better off going now to your elected representative, or you're better off going straight to the minister than through this process? Do you include that in there?
So it wouldn't be to go straight to the minister, because obviously the best way to get a response from the government, if they are the appropriate person to respond, it would be to go through, well, either their member of parliament or through the petitions committee. I mean, that's the exact sort of thing that we can do on behalf of people is get a response from government. But if, for example, they came with a concern about the way a particular situation has been handled by a public authority, you can understand why they would want to come to Parliament to raise that concern. But actually, the appropriate route is to go through their elected member and to, for example, an ombudsman who will take an inquiry into how a public authority has acted. And because the Petitions Committee can't take up individual cases, that is the most appropriate route. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but I'm pretty sure that the team would advise them before it even came to the committee that that's the better course of action for them.
That's absolutely right. If a petition is about something which is not properly a matter for Parliament or government, the team will try and direct the petitioner to where their complaint or their case is better heard.
Yeah, so in the first instance, that's kind of like the recourse for a potential petitioner. Yeah, okay. Maybe we'll just talk a bit more about some of that criteria, and one of them obviously is the sub judice nature of any petition. Do you want to expand on any of those criteria for us, or do you think we've covered enough ground, or you've got anything else to offer?
Do you want to go on that, Mark?
Yes, the rules for the e-petition system, the online petition system, are slightly different from those for the paper petition system. The Commons has a e-off-denying ordinance that governs all its proceedings, which in effect debars it from debating issues that are live before the courts. And I think that's a fairly common arrangement in many parliaments. The e-petition system has a slightly different rule, which is that no court proceedings can be a subject of a petition. It's in effect doing the same thing. And I think it's worth thinking through the reasons for that. The first reason is, of course, that it is for the courts to decide court cases, not for anyone else, and they should not be brought or under any undue influence, and no attempt to be made to look as if they are being brought under an undue influence. But there is a separate issue too, which is that the separation between Parliament and the courts is a constitutional principle, and it is best served by Parliament respecting it as well as by the courts respecting it. And so at the bottom of the sub judice, there's also a principle of what we call comity, which is that the institutions don't stray into each other's territory. Now, we can all think of cases where Parliaments have strayed into the court's territories, and I'm sure we can think of cases where we feel the court may have strayed into Parliament's territory as well. Mm. But the principle is there, and we attempt to adhere to it as far as we can.
Yep. Okay. Any other criteria you might do in the first pass in terms of before it gets to a committee?
I think there's a first pass around language. So the e-petition system does not have some of the formulaic requirements that a paper petition system has. So there's actually a form of words you have to use in a paper's petition, which you may be familiar with, maybe something similar to what you have to just set out the petition. That doesn't apply to the e-petitions, but they do have to avoid being defamatory or abusive or offensive. Quite a lot of petitions lose on the grounds of being offensive,
really?
And that is not just in language, but also in their attitude to in different groups in society or to issues. Now, in theory, Parliament could legislate against basic human rights, but in practice, the team will not consider something to be permissible if it proposes something that would be outside the bounds of what Parliament can reasonably expect it to do, or would be contrary to existing legislation on issues like equalities and human rights.
Yeah, interesting. Are those criteria set out in the standing orders, or is it just the convention, or is it a written rule somewhere on the petitions page or the petitions committee's resolutions?
The rules for the petitions were originally designed by the procedure committee of the House of Commons when it set up the system. They've been reviewed by the petitions committee itself from time to time. At one point, the procedure committee said it would come back to the system, but it's never found the time to do that. Maybe it will one day.
Yeah.
They are owned, if you like, by the House, because they're endorsed by the House when it set up the system, so the House, again, could amend them. But they are designed to be more clearly expressed in terms of public understanding than perhaps standing orders commonly are.
Yeah. Yeah, so it sets clear guidelines for any potential petitioner to say, well, I need to make sure it conforms or I'm not going to get past first base. A useful thing, I think. I think we talked about oral. Just to explore this a bit more, our process in our committee is to, we receive a petition through Parliament, so every petition is read into the Parliament. If it's read into the Legislative Council, which is your equivalent to House of Lords, it always gets referred to this committee. So that's always the first step, is to be read into the Parliament. And as a standing committee of the Parliament, it then sent to us. Our next process is to basically gather evidence, but it's really gathering evidence from the petitioner and the tabling member of Parliament is the first pass. We don't always go into receiving oral evidence, but I notice that you guys often do or make a decision to take oral evidence, including things like the round table. And really, it's about the decision to make that, and how you arrive at it in the first instance. I wonder if you can shed any light on it for us as a committee member, Madam Chair.
So I think it's the sheer volume of the number of petitions that are submitted, because it is online and because it has become a very well-established way of raising issues. Petitioning in general, which I'm sure you experience as well, online petitioning is organised by a whole range of organisations, and the understanding of the difference between the sort of international online organisations that run petitioning and the difference with raising it in Parliament is something that we're always very keen to make clear, the difference and the different outcome that can be expected from that. But I think that does mean that we do have to find different ways of dealing with all of those petitions. Obviously, as Mark explained, many do not actually get presented, or many don't even get over the initial hurdles. But when they do, sometimes we may refer a matter to another select committee if they are already undertaking an inquiry into that issue. And we will keep the petitioners informed that is what we are doing, that is the best way for them to have their concerns heard, by incorporating it within an ongoing inquiry by a more detailed select committee. Or we will, we can tag it to a parliamentary debate. So if there is a debate in the main chamber in Parliament, or indeed in any debating chamber on that issue that those petitioners are concerned about, we can tag their petition to that debate so that it's had a formal hearing as part of that debate, and we make sure that the petitioners are aware of that, and also those who are partaking in the debate are aware that petition has been tagged to it. So really, where we decide to undertake an inquiry is we only do it where we can't find any other means within Parliament of having those concerns considered, and so, you know, we don't undertake inquiries lightly, because we feel that we don't want to duplicate other work that's happening in Parliament. We want to make sure that where we do an inquiry, it's because this is really the only way in which those concerns will get heard. And but the way we undertake inquiries is slightly different to other committees as well. So where we do undertake an inquiry, we like to think that it does add value to the parliamentary process, because we do engage in a more direct way with the public through that inquiry, because of the nature of who it is we're doing it on behalf. That all the people, well, there'll be over 100,000 who generally have signed a petition and asked for these issues to be considered. So we will engage with those. So, for example, on the inquiry that I mentioned about coronavirus, we put a post on the parliamentary Facebook page that we were undertaking this inquiry, and we had 24,000 comments from the public in response to it, which is a huge challenge for the petitions team to go through those to make sure that they get incorporated within the questions that we ask. But it does show the level of public interest and engagement. in the issue. And we also sent out an email to the petitioners and got 60,000 questions back about what they would like to see asked within that inquiry session. It was an hour long on each subject. Obviously, we did our very best to try and incorporate those petitioners' concerns. We do occasionally undertake or pursue an issue where it doesn't necessarily meet those 10,000 and 100,000 criteria, but that's if it's being brought by a group in society that wouldn't normally get that broader representation in terms of numbers. So, for example, we held a debate in Westminster Hall on the use of British Sign Language, which we know is a big concern to that group, but that group itself might not necessarily be able to attract the level that would get them over the threshold to have a debate. But we pioneered in that debate and ensured that we had live British Sign Language interpretation of the debate, which was the first time that was undertaken in a Westminster Hall debate. So things like that, we do look to be, whilst we have very strict criteria, there are occasions where we can adapt it in order to meet the needs of particularly minority groups that wouldn't necessarily get that representation in other ways.
Yeah, and then that falls to the deliberations of the committee, I would assume, in
how they deviate from the criteria. You have to have agree that on a cross-party basis as part of the committee.
We've got a few questions here on, I'm looking at questions 5 and 6, which is a bit about the frivolous or vexatious nature or the repetitive nature of petitions, but I think you've probably answered some of those in terms of a criteria. I don't know if you want to add anything before we move on. I'm just going to deviate slightly, and I'd ask you, Madam Chair, you've got a committee of 11 participating members, is that right?
Yes, so it's made up of a proportionate representation of the makeup of the House of Commons. So it has a majority government members on it, and then a sort of an appropriate allocation of opposition members, so from the Labour Party and the Scottish National Party. And it works well in that everything we do has to be agreed on a cross-party basis, because we are, as a committee, representing the petitioners who are not petitioning us in a party political forum. They are petitioning Parliament, and so the decisions that we make are always agreed on that basis. It is always chaired by an opposition member, has been since its inception, and I think that's important as well to ensure that whilst everything is agreed on a cross-party basis, it is led by an opposition member who will work with cross-party colleagues to ensure that the government is held to account, which is the purpose of the committee on behalf of petitioners. And it also ensures that, depending on the subject that has been raised with the petition, that generally would be leading to a debate, that there is a choice of members who may or may not want to lead on that issue. It may be that they either agree with it or they don't, or they have a constituency interest that actually it links very strongly to, and so they'd be keen to follow it up. But it does provide that variety of perspectives in order to be able to lead that debate in a way that the petitioners can have confidence in. But I think regardless of whether you're opposition or government, regardless of whether you have a personal interest in it or not, whether you agree with it or not, there will always be a member that will lead on a debate. And I think we're always very careful to ensure that the tone is one that recognises that these are the views of the petitioners that we are here to represent, rather than just our own views. And so I think quite often a member will set out the case and make it clear that they don't necessarily agree, but these are the concerns of the petitioners, and this is why they must be heard in Parliament and why the government must now respond.
Yeah, I think they're good values to have. I think the bipartisan approach to committee work. I mean, we're like you, we're a committee of the Parliament. We're not a committee of political parties. So we should be approaching it that way. And my experience on this committee has been that that has always been the approach, and I think we've done good work because of it, rather than hindering it, would be my perception. I don't know if other members agree. So I'm a member of the Conservative Country Party. My colleague here is a member of the Labor Party, and Tim is a member of the Greens Party, as an example. So we all come with our own views of the world, but I think we operate in a very consensus way. Valuable.
And I think the public appreciate that as well. I think Parliament is set up very much, you know, on opposite benches, often with opposing views, which are quite theatrically expressed quite often. And I think the public appreciate sometimes the more calm and level-headed approach that comes from committees. And I think they find it reassuring that we are able to work together and find common ground where possible.
Yeah, I agree. We'll leave the theatre to the Parliament and we'll do the work. Yeah. Just to go back a little bit on meeting petitioners' expectations, our terms of reference say that the function of the committee is to inquire into and report on petitions, whereas a lot of the other jurisdictions usually just have consider petitions, and there is a bit of a language difference. And so I'm interested in some comments from you guys in terms of, do you think there's some expectation built into the language that we use versus the language of others, which is basically considers a petition versus inquire into and report on?
I do think that expectation is really key in how you manage the petitions process and ensure that even though petitioners don't get the outcome that they want, they're not dissatisfied with the process itself. And so we do use the word consider because we do consider every petition. We consider some not suitable for debate. We consider some that actually require further inquiry. We consider some offensive, and therefore they do not make it onto the petitions website. So I think use of the word consider, I think it's appropriate for what we do with our processes, and it does leave the outcome of that consideration very much open to what we feel is most appropriate. I think for us, we use inquiry very specifically in the sense that we will take evidence and generally produce a report at the end of it. That's how I think people would interpret the word inquiry or inquire from our parliamentary, particularly select committee, and also government, where they say they're having an inquiry. You would generally expect some output from that, generally in a formal written report. And I think there is experience actually where, for example, the government have said they are going to inquire into something, that there is dissatisfaction where there isn't a formal written report at the end of that, even though it wasn't necessarily promised. So I think we're quite careful to use the word consider rather than inquire.
I'm just thinking it through too. If in my mind, consider is a much better way to analyse the processes that the committee goes through. And I also think it puts a bit of responsibility back on the petitioner to potentially make sure they provide information that encourages the committee to consider it to its full extent. If you just say we're going to inquire into everything and report on everything, then it probably takes some responsibility away from the petitioner. I'm just thinking about this as you were talking, so I don't know if you got any thoughts on that.
I think it is incumbent on the petitioner to ensure that they ask about issues and present issues in a way that can be considered appropriate and also relevant and necessary. So yeah, I think to say that we will consider it, and then it shows that whatever the outcome, it has been considered. And for some members of the public, that's enough. They just want to know that their concerns have been heard and they have been considered. Obviously, others want specific outcomes from that consideration, and sometimes it's more of a challenge to meet that expectation. But I think the basic expectation that their concerns have been considered, I think is the very least that Parliament can do. Whereas I think to promise to inquire into every concern, I think is a higher threshold to meet.
Okay, thank you.
Could I just add one thing as someone who's had the pleasure of a career of drafting standing orders from time to time? I think obviously your interpretation of your standing orders is entirely a matter for you and not for us. One of the things that consider encompasses, which is very much a responsibility of the Petitions Committee, is the initial assessment of the petition as it arrives on the website. So that initial decision of whether or not it should be accepted to go on the website is the first part of consideration, and then there's further consideration about whether what to do with it thereafter. As I understand your system, the petitions you're looking at have already been presented to the Legislative Council. So they've gone through what we would think of as an initial consideration stage. They have to be in order for the member to present them to the Council. And so, in a sense, definitionally speaking, the consideration, the initial consideration has taken place somewhere else. So one reason why consider doesn't quite capture what you have in the same way as it does capture what the UK Petitions Committee does.
Yeah, I think the process is slightly different, so it makes for a different kind of initial outcome, if you like. But of course, when a petition is read into our Parliament, there's no real drafting, except for some formal words, really. But the issue could be anything. Could be something frivolous in nature, or it could be complete change in government policy. But that first pass doesn't occur until it gets read into the Parliament and comes to the committee. So we've probably got a double challenge in that, because there's none of that first consideration, if you like, before it's even been read in. Whereas yours, there is a consideration even before it gets onto the parliamentary website. Extra challenge for us. You guys got anything?
I
think we've covered a fair bit of ground. I'm just looking through some of the other questions, and maybe if we haven't got to somewhere you've made specific notes, you'd like to make a comment at the end. But I think we've got to most of the issues and an understanding of how your committee works, unless you think there's something that you'd like to add from some of the other questions we've got there.
One of the key things that we have focused on as a committee since we were established in 2015 is where we can add something that isn't already being provided for through Parliament. So whether that's an ability to be a voice for underrepresented groups, whether that's a way of reaching out to members of the public that wouldn't normally engage with Parliament, or whether that's pursuing issues that don't have another means by which they can be pursued in Parliament. And we are more than happy to hand over the work of a particular petition if we think it can be dealt with more effectively by other means, whether that's through an ombudsman or whether that's through another parliamentary committee. And so I think that helps to, in some ways, limit the work that comes to our committee, but also ensure that we get maximum value for the petitioner on the time and the energy that we expend on their behalf. And we have seen some successes in the approach that we've taken, and obviously we refine it as we go along, and we do consider whether we need to review our ways of operating, which is obviously something you're doing now, and we do look to learn from other committees about how they operate internationally and what best practice they can demonstrate that we could perhaps adopt as a committee. But I have to say, one of the things that makes the way that we progress matters slightly different sometimes from other work of Parliament is that very direct engagement with the petitioner. And quite often they might have a very powerful case. And so where that individual member of the public is happy to engage with us or stand on a public platform alongside us, that can be a very powerful campaigning tool. For example, we had our first inquiry that we undertook was a family of someone that had tragically died from a brain tumour. And they were very powerful campaigners. They were very engaging and they were very keen to tell their story to try and bring something positive out of that tragedy. And that in itself enhanced and publicised the work of the petitions committee, because through the fact that we changed government policy, we did achieve greater funding for brain tumour research. They now are powerful advocates for petitioning as a means of bringing about change. And similarly, we are able to, have the comfort of knowing that we've managed to achieve that change on behalf of a petitioner and those that supported the petition as well. So I think getting that balance right between taking on issues that can get media attention and can enhance the role and the view of Parliament on behalf of the public, whilst making sure we're not just treading on everyone's toes in Parliament and duplicating in a way, because we are not limited to a specific policy area. We're limited. We are more unique in the way, in the manner in which we can raise issues. So we work hard to focus on maximising the benefits of that, both to petitioners and to Parliament as a whole, and to make sure that, and again, it's on a cross-party basis, that we enhance the eyes of we enhance Parliament in the eyes of the public, but also we give the public the confidence that their views can be heard and that this is an additional means by which they have to raise their concerns.
Yeah, interesting point, I think, because you are a relatively young committee in being only established in 2015. We've heard evidence from other committees about how some of the issues being petitioned have changed over years, and some that have been going longer, there's some of the frivolous nature ones have been dropped off, and it's much more about some of the bigger policy issues. But I was just thinking when you were talking about while the public see the committee's work as being worthwhile, what's the feedback from the Parliament itself in terms of recognising the committee's work?
So it's interesting that actually I would say that the public are much more aware of the work of the Petitions Committee than necessarily Parliament itself. And I think that they would probably be surprised to discover that petitions debates get more views than Prime Minister's questions. And they get more public engagement. Like we have the record for public engagement on the recent coronavirus inquiry session that we had last week. And I think it comes from that, the fact that the issues emanate directly from not just one member of the public, but generally at least 100,000 members of the public, and that the Petitions Committee team are very good at engaging with them to ensure that they feed into how we progress the matter, that they can feed back on their views, and that they're kept informed of as and when things are being progressed. And so I think we're working hard to ensure that Parliament understands the role of the Petitions Committee and also the opportunities that exist for them to collaborate with us. So for example, we have, there are a lot of issues related to coronavirus. We aren't able to inquire into all of them. Some committees will be undertaking inquiries that will very much meet the requirements of a petition. And to find a way of ensuring that the Transport Committee, for example, if it was relating to travel and the impact of COVID on that, that they recognise the value of working together and having direct access to those members of the public that clearly have a very strong interest in that issue. And so to find ways of working with other committees and then taking it forward ourselves where there isn't another means to do so within Parliament. And I think you're right, it is a fairly recent phenomenon, but I think the public are very engaged with it. I think we do need to, there's more we can do to enhance how we work with the rest of Parliament.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm probably just going to go back to question 9 just to get a response if we can, which is around how the processes of closing a petition And often we close a petition and we write to the petitioner, but really don't give any potential reasons why we're closing a petition. And it's probably a bit of a gap in terms of meeting people's expectations or open and transparency of the process. And I don't know if you've got any parallel processes that go on with your petition system about closing petitions and then giving reasons for that decision.
I don't know if you want to come on this, Mark, because it's some of it's technical, but I mean, obviously we're very careful with data, and we always ensure that we would never keep anything open longer than it should be, which we would never hold on to data longer than we should. So we dispose our petitioner's data 6 months after a petition closes, and so that's up to a year after they have signed that petition. But in the meantime, we do everything we can to keep that petitioner updated as to how things are progressing, how it's being taken forward. But we have quite fixed timelines for when a petition will be closed, regardless of what the outcome might have been from however we actioned the petition. It's a fixed timetable. Is that correct, Mark?
Yes, that's right, I think, yeah. So the petition is live for 6 months, and everyone knows from the outset that that's the duration of the online, of its online presence.
Yeah. But then inquiries out of that petition can go on for much longer?
Yeah, so if we, our decision of how we process that petition is to undertake an inquiry, yes, it could potentially run on longer, which is why we hold on to the petitioner's data for 6 months after it has closed in order to ensure that they can keep updated on any action that isn't completed within that 6 month period.
Okay, anything from you guys? Well, I think we've come almost to the end. If we've got any follow-up questions, I'm sure our staff will contact you. I'm just going to read a closing statement before we finish. So a transcript of this hearing will be forwarded to you for correction. If you believe that any corrections should be made because of typographical or transcription errors, please indicate these corrections on the transcript. Errors of fact or substance must be corrected in a formal letter to the committee. Can I just say thank you so much for joining us this morning or this evening. We really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to engage with us as a committee.